Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 2nd, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is our presenter, Don Coberly. Today's session number is 99-5, and the title is Geology and the Earth, Part 5, Study the Earth, Your Life Just Might Depend on It. And let's listen to Don.
Are listening to this on tape at some point in the future. It's been really hot and dry here the last 10 days. And, if you live along the San Andreas Fault, then you understand that geology has an impact on the things living on the planet. And the sort of way that we've trundled along to get to where we are right now is through a study of the idea of plate tectonics, which is the sort of central theory of the science of geology. And it says essentially that the surface of the globe is covered with 8 big plates and 10 small plates, and these are rigid plates. And they sort of bump into each other because the next layer below them is sort of plastic. It's solid and it's made out of rock, but over a long time frame, geologic time, it acts sort of like a plastic, like molasses or something along that idea, so that the plates sort of bump around on top of it and run into each other. And when India runs into China, which is what happened, you form the Himalayan mountains. Things like that. And at the end of Wednesday's talk, where we first started talking about plate tectonics, Aaron asked me a question, so he and I sorted it out between the two of us. And so Thursday, when Mark asked me the same question, I had a really good answer for it. And it's a really good bridge from sort of this idea of plate tectonics into some basic concepts of what I think to be the way that the solid Earth impacts the life on the Earth. And the question that both Aaron and Mark had was, we talked in this plate tectonics idea about it, at a certain point there being this huge supercontinent called Pangaea, where all of the land was together at one place on the globe. And to both of them, that seems a little bit non-random. If you got land masses on the globe, they should kind of be evenly distributed, and yet they're all in one place. How does that happen? Why does that happen? And so with the advent of plate tectonics and people started thinking about it and people started seeing that same thing, the geologic record indicates that there is a previous sort of one of these supercontinents. So you have a supercontinent and then all the continents sort of split up, and then you have in time another supercontinent forming, and now we're in the process, we've split up. Is there some rationale for that? And the idea that's been put forward, there's no real good reason for why the cycle got started, but the idea for why the cycle continues is that if you have this supercontinent, the driving mechanism of plate tectonics is convection of heat away from the center of the Earth, because the center of the Earth is very hot and the surface is cold. And so convection cells form and drive heat away from the center. Well, if you've got a big supercontinent sitting on one part of the globe, the convection cell underneath the supercontinent isn't doing its job very well, right? It's trying to get heat away and can't do it, because instead of trying to get that, when you get to the surface, the heat has to go through solid rock, and other places it's going through 6 kilometers of oceanic crust, and under this big supercontinent it's trying to get through 40 kilometers of continental crust. So the theory is, over time, that convection cell gets stronger and gets bigger, and at some point is essentially responsible for ripping that supercontinent apart. Now, the idea is heat dissipates from hot areas to cold areas. So the big theory is that those continents are being driven by this a little bit bigger convection cell, and they start heading for the cold place. Well, where's the cold place? The cold place is on the other side of the globe, the other side of the planet. So on a sort of grand scheme of things, you kind of have these supercontinents starting on one side of the planet, breaking apart, bouncing around, meeting each other again on the other side of the planet 200 million years later, 300 million years later, forming another supercontinent. That's the way things stay for a while. The convection cell finally breaks it apart. They wind up back on the other side another 200 million years later. And that's been called the supercontinent cycle. Is it true? I don't know. Is it a reasonable hypothesis? Yeah, it seems okay. So the bridge from that sort of idea into what we're going to talk about today, the effect of the solid Earth on the Tree of Life, is when you form these supercontinents, what happens? There has to be other impacts on the planet. One of those things that happens is that sea level generally gets lower. You don't have, we talked yesterday about these mid-ocean ridges, the big long mountain chains that lie under the sea. Well, if you don't have fractures between lots of little continents, if all you have is one big continent, you don't have all these mid-ocean ridges running all through the ocean basins. You have less material built up under the ocean, you don't have any of these mountain ranges, therefore there's more room for water to be. So what happens is the water sort of drains off the land. Same way that when you're sitting in the bathtub and the bathtub drains off, there's more of you that gets exposed. When that happens to rocks, geology, that stuff gets eroded, gets put into the sea. Now the material, the silicon, or the silicates that we talked about on Tuesday when we were talking for about 10 minutes about the chemistry of the planet, those materials, when they get into water, like to react with carbon, particularly carbon dioxide. It sort of sucks carbon dioxide out of the water. Carbon dioxide levels in the water need to be in chemical equilibrium with the carbon dioxide levels in the air. You suck carbon dioxide out of the air. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. You have less greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. Things get colder. Things get colder and glaciers start to form. Glaciers start to form, and now you had water that used to be in the ocean that's now in the glaciers. Sea levels continue to go down. So, I don't know if it's the primary thing, certainly one of the characteristics of this supercontinent cycle is that it's usually a time of low sea level. Another thing that happens in the oceans is there is a generally larger amount of circulation at that time. Because if you have a big supercontinent on the other side of the ocean, whenever the sun shines on that water, it gets hot. Hot stuff tries to go where it's cold. You have these glaciers on the continent. It's relatively colder there, so you have these circulation systems built up in the oceans. What that does is you have a lot, besides the silicate minerals that get washed off the continents, you also wash off those other things that we talked about there being a lot of in the chemistry, calcium, magnesium, sodium, and potassium. Creatures in the sea see that as nutrients. So you have lots of nutrients in the water. You have a good circulation system. And the other thing that you have is a lot of the sort of environmental niches, the places where different creatures can live, get wiped out because that shoreline area, what used to be the shoreline is now dry, that's a real productive part of the ecosystem. So all those get dried out. Nobody can live there because what used to be wet's now dry. Sea levels sink. There's lots of nutrients. It's being circulated very well, so the hypothesis is there is a lot of stuff, a lot of animals, a lot of creatures that thrive, but there's not a very big diversity because there aren't that many different places to live. That's what's hypothesized to happen as one of these supercontinents is together. Now, when the supercontinent breaks apart, things change. And again, what starts that cycle is that the big plume underneath the supercontinent, it starts to break pieces of the continent apart. In order to continue to move those, more of these ocean ridges form, the mid-ocean ridges form. One of the things that those mid-ocean ridges spew back out is carbon dioxide. Now the atmosphere has to go back into equilibrium with water that has more carbon dioxide in it. You get more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's a greenhouse gas, things start to warm up. At the same time, as you break these supercontinents apart, whereas you used to have just a little ring around the whole thing of good living ground, this continental, right at the edge of the continent, when you break that up, now you have a little bit around one piece and more around another piece, and geometry dictates that there's more area that way. So now you have more good living space. Another thing that happens is the glaciers melt, so water goes back into the oceans. There may be a component of this glacial water, cold water, adding more nutrients into the system. You have more good living room. The circulation, general circulation of the ocean goes down, so the nutrient level goes down. And again, the hypothesis is you've taken this ecosystem that was not very diverse, presented it with a bunch of new places to live, and cut down the food supply. So that those things that learn to live in places where nobody else will live, or adapt better, probably will do better under the new conditions. So that in the grand scheme of things, it appears that it's with these breakups of the supercontinents that life sort of goes into a new phase or explodes again. That's the general idea that's suggested by this supercontinent cycle. And so let's see, again, we've talked all week long about the idea of a theory is that it helps us explain what we see. So there's the theory. Let's talk about life on the planet a little bit and see whether or not the theory matches with what it is we see. Most of what I'm going to talk about today comes from a book called Earth Story, which is a companion to a six-hour BBC series. One of the things that I've talked about all week long is trying to direct you to things that I think are particularly good. And that television series called Earth Story that I saw on the Learning Channel earlier this year is just simply the best 6 hours of television that anybody's ever done. Now, if you're not a geologist, you may think it's not quite that good, but it's just excellent. And I spent a fair amount of time on the internet looking for the Learning Channel and looking for BBC video productions so I could buy a copy of it, and couldn't do that, or I haven't been able to find it yet. But it's just, I highly recommend it. If you ever see that on the television, dial it in, change over from, you know, wrestling or whatever else, and check it out. Oh, and by the way, that question that Aaron came up with originally and then Mark followed up with is talked about in this book, Naked Earth, that I've been talking to you about as well. Further proof that this is a really good book. Okay. You know, it's Friday, and I've been passing these packets out for like 5 days now, and finally realized that maybe I should talk about them for a few seconds before we got into it. So I'll be way better about that next week. But the first two pages that you have are a figure that's taken out of this book, Earth Story, that sort of is a timeline. And this is the first place that I've seen this done where both comments on the evolution of life on the planet, and then up in the little globes, there's sort of a picture about what we understand to be, here's the way the continents were distributed on the planet. This is another just superb graphic, I think. You've got a graph in there that I've taken from another source, and all it does is look at the number of species or a sort of qualitative idea of the number of species that have occurred or existed at various places in time. Yes?
What is the scale on the y-axis?
It's 5.42. Variable. It's 40 is more than 20. I mean, I don't think there's any association with families or phyla or anything like that. It's just a qualitative. Where the peaks are high, there's more stuff. Where the peaks are low, there's less stuff. And so at some point when you've got some free time, if you want to compare what Lambert thinks about the species diversity, and you can compare it to the extinctions and explosions on the front thing, you'll see how well these folks agree on their interpretation of things. The last thing is a copy of a newspaper article from the Portland or from the Oregonian in April of 1999 that presents some new information that we need to add onto our chart here from Earth Story that talks about another geologic event that apparently has had some impact on life on the planet. If it didn't, I wouldn't have, you know, photocopied it and shown it to you. So, all right, the basic idea from plate tectonics is that the plates have rearranged the continents at various places during the course of time. And to me, what I think about is that means that conditions change. And so how does life deal with these changing conditions? One of the things that we see in the fossil record of the planet is that at various points there are what are called mass extinctions. And on your chart here of peaks and valleys, there are two or three times in the history of the planet where things take a pretty big dive. And what that means is that a lot of stuff that was alive after a million or 2 years is all dead. And it was a bad time to be on the planet. The reasons that have been hypothesized for those are either major large-scale volcanic eruptions, and these would be over periods of not longer than a week, but less than like 5 million years, meteorite impacts, and changes in climate. And I think that changes in climate, you have to invoke one of those first two. I mean, it's not a particular thing that sort of sits on its own. It's partly due to those first two things I talked about, either meteorite impacts or large-scale volcanic events. And in the read, there's nothing that ever talks about epidemics of things, because those sort of, it would seem that if you kill off dinosaurs and plants at the same time, how does the same thing that kill off the dinosaur kill off the plants? So I don't know how you get a flu. You know, when people died of the flu back in whenever that was, 1200, 1300s, the plants did fine, right? I think. I never heard of any plant flu deaths, so. So it has to be something global, and I think it is related to the solid Earth. Okay, let's talk about life on the planet for a minute and how it got started. Well, let's talk about that in a minute. Let's talk about, where's the first evidence? What's the oldest evidence of life on the planet? And in rocks that are about 3.8 billion years old, there is the first potential evidence comes from rocks of that time. But of course, since that's about as old as rocks get, there wouldn't be any record of fossils in rocks because there were no rocks before that. Rocks that are 3.8 billion years old, there's some rocks up in Greenland or up north somewhere in northern Canada, and some of them contain carbon. And if you take carbon from us and you take carbon from out there, it's a little bit different. The isotopic, I don't know how you say that, the ratio is a little bit different. And so these 3.8 billion year old rocks containing carbon with the isotopic concentrations or ratio of us, or at least of living things rather than of non-living things. Now, are there other explanations for why that ratio might be different than we find today in rocks? And the same is, yeah, there's a possibility. But it's the first kind of thread of evidence that we have of anything related to life. The next sort of better idea that something might be alive is back in 96, a geologist and a paleontologist down in South Africa found some fossils. They think they're fossils in rocks, and they think they're fossils because they have the exact same size and shape as bacteria that we find today. Now, I don't think you find a fossil of a bacteria the same way that you think of other fossils, like imprints or bones or something like that. But the chemistry is different in this little zone, and it has the same shape. It almost looks like a piece of rice at 100,000 times magnification as things that we find today that are bacteria. Bacteria are prokaryotes. They're single-celled organisms, and they don't have little subunits inside. They don't have a nucleus that contains DNA, and they don't have specialized things within them to do specialized. They don't have specialized separate zones within the cell to do different things. It's just a single bag with stuff inside it that somehow takes energy from outside and lives. These initial, let's call them fossils of bacteria, are found in a rock called Chert. And that rock is precipitated out at hot spring areas. And we think that the Chert that this stuff was found in was in a hot spring area or an area of volcanic activity, because right adjacent to it was some of this pillow lava that we talked about yesterday, that real distinctive shaped lava that when hot material comes out and meets into cold seawater, it forms these sort of oblong and like if you had melted bowling balls is what it looks like. So that they're kind of plasticky and they run into each other and they get all odd shaped, but it's very distinctive. So they find these pillow lavas right next to these Cherts with the bacteria fossils in them and say, is it possible that these bacteria somehow are related to the volcanic activity that was responsible for the pillow lavas and the Cherts? These little critters, these little bacteria that they find, they also find that they find them in these primitive rocks. The place that they find them today is right next to these black smokers that we talked about, that I tried to get you to focus on yesterday when we were talking about the mid-ocean ridges. These black smokers that funnel water through them. And if I don't talk the full hour, we'll look at a little bit of tape to show those. So you find them in ancient rocks, in hot spring areas or volcanic activity areas. You find them today in hot spring areas or volcanic activity areas. So maybe we can go back to the past and say that's where they started. Now these bacteria, at least the ones we see today, they get their energy in a different way. It's not photosynthesis, they call it chemosynthesis. And seeing this on TV back in January for the first time is the first time I had heard about it. And it says that they get their energy from the hydrogen sulfide in the black smoker when it results with dissolved carbon dioxide and oxygen in ordinary seawater, a unique mode of feeding known as chemosynthesis. So this is not photosynthesis, or it's not eating other stuff. It's somehow taking energy that's released by a chemical reaction where the chemicals come from the solid earth. I'm trying to present all the information that sort of works in along with the thesis that I'm trying to present, so that's why I'll keep going back and stuff like that. Additionally, this water that comes from these black smokers contains a bunch of other molecules that are commonly found in living organisms, including simple amino acids. Now, I don't know where all of you are about how life got created in the first place. And we can talk about that and hypothesize about it over a cup of tea. And I'd love to do that because I think some of the evidence points in a certain direction, but I'd like to read you a few paragraphs from this book, Earth Story, about that. It is possible to imagine a situation where a stable chemical environment was set up within the confines of an inorganic semi-permeable membrane. One suggestion is that primitive semi-permeable membranes were cell-like silica or metal crusts. Such natural bubbles are commonly observed today around hot springs. The hot water in such a volcanic environment would be rich in many chemicals, including metal ions essential for lifelike reactions. Nucleotides and other molecules could come together to form simple macromolecules. This way we would have the beginnings of genes. If by chance any of these macromolecules were capable of replication, then its concentration would start to increase. At some point, the original inorganic membranes may have become templates for organic membrane constructions. At that point, the membranes and their contents could have become free cells. If by chance one of these membranes got pinched off, like a soap bubble, the cell would have effectively reproduced. Any membrane system that has a tendency to split would increase in number, and so on. The steps are all very speculative, but in principle it is possible to conceive how, through natural selection, a replicating single cell could come about. Now, the first time I read that, it sounds to me sort of like how I would explain to Mom how the lamp got broke. It's the origin of life, when one of us figures it out, will clearly get the Nobel Prize. To me, it's a series of highly improbable events. And when you take highly improbable events and link them together, the statistics of it means that the chance against it grows exponentially. So you have a series of highly improbable events taking place for an inconceivably long period of time. And it's not an issue that I've resolved to my satisfaction yet as to how this got started, because if I had, then I'd publish it and get the Nobel Prize. So maybe it happened this way, and yet if it's more important to you that it didn't happen this way, there's plenty of room for it to have not have happened that way. So that's my soapbox on the origin of life that I don't understand. But if it turns out the way it says in the book, then the implication is that in its earliest phases, life was supported by the earth, not by plants, not by the sun, by the rocks and the water flowing through the rocks. Somehow, these chemosynthetic bacteria, after they've come into existence, something about that, their structure changes so that now, rather than needing hot black smoker water, they use sunlight. How that happens, it's another one of those, it's really hard to imagine, but we have a lot of time, so maybe it turned out that way. Once that happens, then the bacteria are no longer stuck to these hot springs. They can go pretty much wherever they want to, as long as there's sunlight there. So the shallow seas would be a good place to go from there. At this point in Earth's history, life sort of, one of the things I said in the opening back on Monday as a corollary to the Earth impacting life also impacts the Earth. And the way that this was proposed to happen is once these bacteria became photosynthetic, then they started to generate oxygen. And at some point created atmosphere. And this impacts the planet because where iron comes in contact with free oxygen, it oxidizes, it rusts, and it drops out wherever it happens to be, like on the tailings piles. If there's no free oxygen in the atmosphere, that iron is free to sort of be transported by the water and go wherever the water goes. And there are formations in Australia particularly called banded iron formations where iron has apparently been laid down in real clear open seas. And if there had been oxygen in the atmosphere at that point, that could not have happened. Wherever that iron first came in contact with the oxygen, it would have dropped out. And so there are geologic formations that occurred before there was oxygen or they occurred at that time and haven't occurred since because of the impact of life on the geology. Additionally, once you get oxygen in the atmosphere, that same iron that used to be in the lakes is now sitting up on the tailings pile because you've got wherever it happens to come out or wherever it first gets in contact with the environment, that's got oxygen and it drops out. So a little bit later in time in Australia, where you no longer find these banded iron formations, you find what are called red beds. And you also find them in Colorado and other places on the planet. And that's a geologic indication that now there is oxygen in the atmosphere and there's free oxygen in the atmosphere. The things that these photosynthetic bacteria at some point sort of colonized together, and the first geologic structure that is composed of that is a thing called stromatolites. The oldest ones of those are 3.5 billion years old. The anticipation is by about 2.1 billion years old, there is enough oxygen in the atmosphere to quit the deposition of these banded iron formations and start the deposition of red beds. There's other geologic evidence for this as well in materials. Besides the red beds, other materials that we find at the planet, like types of uranium that aren't stable in oxygen. Wait a minute, that's not right. Right, we find them in older rocks. Now that you get oxygen, we don't find them. Sorry. At some point later on in time, these prokaryotes, the single-celled units somehow turned into eukaryotes, which are also single-celled, but they have these compartments inside. They have a nucleus that contains genetic material, and they have mitochondria for making energy, and they're more complicated. That's another one of those things that how did you go from a prokaryote to a eukaryote? The string of little things that need to happen is probably a little bit less than the original string of going from silica to prokaryote, but again, there's a bunch of steps that need to be explained. Once you go to a eukaryote, there's more stuff to you as an individual, and therefore there's more chance for diversity. Whether that happened accidentally through some genetic, as the eukaryotes were replicating, whether there was a bad copying job done, or whether there was incoming radiation that somehow changed the eukaryotes, now there is a greater chance for different stuff to happen, different things to be created. And it's about at this 2.1 billion years ago time that the first eukaryote, or what we think to be eukaryotes, simply because they're larger and sort of a different shape than the prokaryotes, came into existence, and that's a family called Gripania, and it looks kind of like spaghetti. The difference in its appearance is the primary idea. The difference in appearance and difference in size is the primary reason that paleontologists think that this is really a eukaryote rather than a prokaryote. Prokaryotes also at this time were sort of diversifying on their own and getting larger. This gets us to about 1.3 billion years ago. And if you look on your handout, I think this is the point that is the starting of the, what they call amalgamation, the starting of coming together of land masses to create the first supercontinent. It's the first supercontinent that we think we see evidence of, and the evidence is kind of sketchy, but it's over this time frame that continents sort of start to ram together and form this first supercontinent called Rodinia. And yes?
For clarification and reading this timeline, it seems to go start on the bottom and go to the next page.
Exactly. It's two pages wide. This is going to be interesting. Two pages wide, starts down here, runs across the bottom, bump up a level, run across again. Yeah, you're exactly right. So, for those of you who were confused before, thank you for pointing that out. Rodinia forms, all of those things we talked about as being part of the supercontinent cycle, we assume happened. There was glaciation at that time. And those bigger prokaryotes called acritarchs wound up going extinct. It's the first great extinction in the history of the planet, that, at least that we have record of. And then at about 590 million years ago, that was the latest time of cooling, the cooling related to the supercontinent formation, things began to warm up. The breakup of Rodinia starts, and we have the first chance to see whether or not the idea of breaking up of a supercontinent has any impact on life on the planet. And the first thing that we find, or right after that, we find the first multicellular animals on the planet. Those are called the Ediacara fauna, and those are found fairly widespread, at least to the southern continents, as far as I know. I'm not sure, paleontology is not really my thing, so I can't tell you much more than that. 590 million years ago, old, we find this first multicellular animals, and then by about 550 million years old, we have what's called the Cambrian explosion. And I don't know if that's listed as such on your, yeah, right at the top of the, or right at the right-hand side, left-hand side of the second line. And all of a sudden you go from a few multicellular animals and things to a whole bunch of stuff. Worms, crabs, shellfish, sea urchins, sponges, things with sort of early skeletons, things with plates, so that now they're easier to find the fossils of. And I guess my way of thinking about this is the same way that when you go from a prokaryote that has no nucleus to a eukaryote that has a nucleus in these things that are called organelles, as things get more complicated, there's more chance for things to go different directions. When you go from unicellular animals to multicellular animals, there's another one of these chances for things to go all sorts of different directions, and that's apparently what happened, because you find all different kinds of life that you didn't find a little while ago. Either one of those explanations is reasonable. The one is sort of related more to the solid Earth, that it's this, there are more, things got warmer, there are more shelf areas for things to live in, and therefore the solid Earth is responsible for this Cambrian explosion. The other one is you go from unicellular to multicellular, and if Rodinia had stayed together and it stayed cold, it still would have happened, just because things get more complicated. I don't know. One of the things that happened as life diversified at that point was it's the first time that any sort of communities, environmental communities, is that the you got different ways to live. Rather than just sort of feeding on either sunlight or chemical stuff, now you can feed on each other. So it's the first time that there's any idea that there were predators out there. There are shells from those days that are found with borings in them that indicated that not only was there stuff that lived someplace that had a shell, but there was something that tried to bore in and eat its soft parts out. The stromatolites sort of decline and in the end die out, and the theory is that there was stuff that grazed on those stromatolites. So all kinds of what do you call those? I mean, sorry?
Predators?
Well, yeah, but you have predators and you have prey and you have
community.
Different ways of getting your business done and living. Scavengers that clean up after the predators who've eaten the prey. So it's the first time in life history that there's a chance for something like that to happen. There is a location up in British Columbia called the Burgess Shale, which is sort of the treasure trove of life, of fossils of life from this time. And one of the reasons that we hypothesize that there are more stuff to see at this point is because there are now types of skeletons and scales and things that we can see, and therefore they get preserved in the fossils. Another reason that we think that there were predators at that time is that some of these fossils look like they're sort of like armor plates, or they're spines that have pointy ends to keep things from eating you, and some things have collecting arms so that they can grab you. This is all in the water and, you know, jellyfish kind of things, but some of it that is now starting to form more structure to it than that. And there's indications that things have arms so that they can scoop you closer to their mouth or whatever it is they eat with. And so life flourishes through the Cambrian. At about 440 million years ago, the southern, what we now think of as the southern continent, South America, Africa, Australia, and the Antarctic, have started to head towards each other to form the southern part of Pangaea, and it's called Gondwana. And these ideas that we talk about when things sort of come together, the climate gets colder, there's glaciation, there is a mass extinction at that time. Now, I don't know whether we have enough sophistication in paleontology to see how global that is. I assume by looking at rocks from North America, you would know that whether that stuff that was in the southern part of the globe really had impacts where you were or not. Again, that's one of those things. Paleontology isn't my thing, so I can't advise on that. Anyway, there's a mass extinction at that point. A lot of 75% of all marine creatures, the fossils go out in under a million years. And so the pattern that seems to be set up at that point is that life expands and explodes and goes every which direction until something related to the climate sort of puts a brakes on things. And in this case, it was the coming together of Gondwana land, changing the climate, cooling things off, and killing a bunch of stuff off. It seems like then when the conditions get better, life comes back bigger and stronger than ever and goes about its business every place it can find until the next event, and there is sort of a cycle set up. That during the good times, the best things to do are to be bigger than anything else or to be more specialized than anything else, so that you can take food away from something smaller than you, or you can live someplace that nobody else lives. When it gets to be the bad times, it's probably better to be smaller because you don't have that big a food requirement, and it's better to be more adaptable. So it seems as though there are those characteristics that we think of for creatures, and the actions of the earth over long periods of time sort of change the rules of the playing field enough that some days the big guys are in charge and other days they're all dead, so the little guys get to take over. I don't know if there's any grander idea that can be taken out of that, but we'll stick to geology. During this period of time, it's gotten to the point where the influence of tides, again, something related to the solid Earth or maybe the moon in this case, there's some hypothesis that it's the tides that are responsible for being able to move from living in water to living on land, because they generate generate parts of the planet that are in the water for part of the day and out of the water for part of the day. And that would allow seaweed that at one point had to be in water all day to be in water most of the day, to be in water part of the day, to be in water none of the day. It's a hypothesis. There's a lot of time in there. Maybe that's the way things work. One of the things that would happen was if you were sort of the first plant on the land, you had a big wide world to work in where nobody else could trouble you. And you weren't dependent on this change, or you weren't impacted by these changes in sea level. So when things finally made it onto dry land, they moved from the edge of dry land to pretty much everywhere pretty quickly because they had a free rein on things. There was nothing, once you got onto land, you were the only thing there. There was nothing that was in the water that was eating you, and you weren't dependent on this, the water always being sort of the same level. You were dependent on there being rain, but that apparently was less of a problem. Animals soon follow, maybe for the same reasons, that they had food sources there that they didn't have to compete for. So that by the early Devonian, about 400 million years ago, things sort of, I guess, took a little bit of a jump, and there were creatures on dry land or muddy land or something along those lines. The first things that made it were worms and snails, and things that are now, they're sort of ancestors to millipedes, and one of the first things on land is apparently scorpions. So if you don't like them, that's bad news. I don't particularly like scorpions, so it's unfortunate that they ever made it out of the water. There were no animals on the land until fishes developed bones so that they could support themselves as they got to be no longer in the water but under the influence of gravity. This happened about the end of the Devonian, and at that point there are fossils that show fishes that have spines that are made up of little pieces that are held, apparently were held together with some sort of connective tissue, and they have limbs. They were called flippers. And then 400 million years later, you have creatures that have spines that are held together by connective tissue that have limbs. So in some senses, things haven't changed very much since then. Things are going good until we get to the end of the Permian. 250 million years ago, is that what they say on here? Okay. At this point, and prior to this, but by this point, probably about 300 million years ago, Pangaea has pretty much fully formed. The best preserved, it's the supercontinent that we think we have the most confidence in having existed. It's fully formed. All of these supercontinent put together ideas have started to come into play. As far as putting more, the water levels drop, all the good living ground is gone, it's getting colder, glaciers are starting to happen. And then at the end of the Permian, what's shown on your timeline here as the Siberian eruptions. There's an eruption of a rock type called basalt that they find in Siberia that covers 965,000 square miles. Now, that means you take a square 982 miles on a side, and the basalt that they find there is about 2 miles deep. A lot of rock. Now, as that stuff was being blown out as part of the, and I guess think about a Hawaiian island kind of eruption, only like a million times bigger. It wasn't real explosive volcanism, but at the same time, what was generated was carbon dioxide and dust and water vapor and sulfur dioxide. And this is the first instance and the first example of there being acid rain on the planet. That sulfur dioxide mixes with the water in the atmosphere, and suddenly you have acid rain. And acid rain on a scale that is unimaginable. Well, it's rather than being limited to the northeast part of the United States and some certain industrial parts of Europe, it's everywhere. Every time it rains, it's acid rain, because this stuff is everywhere. Got acid rain, things are getting colder, the dust in the atmosphere has blocked out the sun. It's a bad time to be on the planet. 90% of the marine species go extinct, and 90% of the four-legged land animal species go extinct. It's a bad time to be on the planet. That's the reason most geologists and paleontologists think of for this is that it's related to this explosion, and it's related to the other supercontinent cycles. Other geologists believe that one of the things that happens about that same time is that water levels are at their lowest recorded point ever, and certain geologists believe that you can't explain that low water level simply by the supercontinent cycle. So whether there was something going on in general on the planet and these Siberian explosions were just the last nail in the coffin, it's hard to say. But you kill off 90% of the stuff that's in the water and 90% of the stuff that's on the land that crawls around on four legs, you slice out a big part of the stuff that's living. One of the things that happens at that point is Pangaea. We talked yesterday when we were describing the various regimes of plate tectonics. One of the things that happens is that oceanic crust sort of gets pushed down underneath the continents. And one of the things that happens is that it sort of pushes up the edges of the continents as it's going down. There is sort of a snowplow effect is what I think of it as. It scrapes off material from the plate that's going down, and it sort of pushes up and makes little mountain ranges that you find all along the coast. The theory is what happened is that material that was pushed up right along the coast was old coal swampy stuff. All the plants that had lived near the ocean or lived near the coast and then had died and had formed these big thick coal deposits, that material was now brought back up into the environment, into the atmosphere. It was available to be weathered. It was available to be put back into the atmosphere. Now we're back into there being more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The atmosphere warms up, and now we get to that the cycle continues. The atmosphere warms up, the glaciers melt, the sea rises again, and now we're back into good times. And not only are we into good times, but we've cleaned out 90% of the stuff that was alive on the planet beforehand. So there should likely be another one of these explosions. And so by 200 million years ago, you get to the dinosaurs. And we get to the period of dinosaurs, of age of dinosaurs, whatever you want to call that. And remember, when times are good, it's either good to be big or to be specialized. And there were mammals around during this period, but they were really small, shrew and sort of mouse size, and they were real generalists. So for that whatever period of time it was, from 200 million years ago to 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs ruled the earth and the mammals sort of hid in the grass and quaked. Pangaea starts to break up at this point. So at this point, we begin to isolate populations from one another for the first time, or since the first time in 100 million years, continents are starting to split apart and things can be isolated from one another. 120 million years ago, the southern continents start to move apart from each other. It's warm. There's volcanic activity, the earth which helps warm up the earth, and from 200 million years ago to about 65 million years ago, it's good times. So the dinosaurs do well. Now, about 65 million years ago, two things happen. First off, there is a basalt deposit in India that's not quite as large as the one in Siberia, but still extremely big, and we can presume that the same sorts of things would happen. It would have dust, although not as much. It would have sulfur dioxide, which would go up and make acid rain. The earth would start to cool. Living wouldn't start to be so good anymore. And then the meteorite hit. There's evidence in rocks in Mexico, or in a crater in Mexico, that about 65 million years ago, a meteorite hit the Earth at that point. A meteorite is theorized to be about 10 kilometers in diameter. So that'd be about 6 miles in diameter. It's another one of those things in geology that sort of for us is simply inconceivable. It says, or the reading that I did says that the impact crater is 115 miles across. And you can see this in Landsat images. One of the reasons that it was so hard to find is because it was so stinking big. People were looking for it and looking. You know, if you put a microscope up against an elephant, you don't see much, right? You see something, but you don't see the whole picture. So there's an impact crater there that's 115 miles across. The firestorm that would have been created by that would have, in 1916, just to sort of confuse the issue a little bit more, there was a meteorite that hit in Russia, and it took them a while to figure it out because they couldn't understand the magnitude of the destruction. What was simply how could it have happened? And because the impact crater was really so small, and the meteorite, by the time they figured it out, was so deep, it was a mystery for quite a while. If you take the size that they found of the meteorite and the destruction that was involved, and then you take that meteorite and blow it up to 6 miles across, the hypothesis is that everything within hundreds of miles or 500 worth of miles would have been burned and incinerated and turned to dust. To make the issue worse, if it could get worse, the meteorite hit an area that is underlain by a rock that's called gypsum. And one of the things that's found in gypsum is sulfate. The chemical formula for gypsum is CaSO4. That S is for sulfate. So that launched a whole bunch of other stuff up into the atmosphere. And as if things weren't bad enough, now you load up the atmosphere with more sulfate. One of the estimations is that at that point, the acid rain was so bad that the surface of the ocean, the pH of that was about 3. Now, I don't know what that matches up to on some, you know, what is it that's in your cabinet that has a pH of 3, but it's just highly acidic. It's more acidic than any of the acid lakes that we find back in the Northeast or back in Europe.
Extra strong vinegar.
Okay, extra strong vinegar. So try living in that. My only, I guess what I think about when I think about this is why it didn't kill everything? How anything survived? Most of the marine organisms, anything that was living in the ocean got killed, went extinct. And anything that was living on land and was bigger than about 25 kilograms, they said, went extinct in the book, in Earth Story.
Every place on land?
Yeah. So it was a bad time to be a dinosaur unless you were a really light dinosaur. There weren't any of those, so none of them made it. Now again, prior to this, in geologic time, there was a little hint that things were starting to go downhill, but between the eruptions that we see the record of in India and then the meteorite impact, it sort of, those were the last two nails in that big coffin. Now we've gotten to the end of the Cretaceous, and we've had our mass extinction, and about a million years later, things have started to rebound. The dinosaurs are gone. The woodlands can come back, those that didn't get burned out before, and those that have survived this acid rain and darkness. And the mammals, who have been hiding in the weeds for the last 200 million or 150 million years, can come out, and there's nobody there left for them to compete with, so now there's this explosion in mammals. One of the orders of mammals is called primates, and that includes apes. And within that order is a family called Hominidae. I just can't say that word. Two of the things that are in that family are chimpanzees and humans. And chimpanzees and humans share about 98% of their DNA. The differences between chimpanzees and humans comes down to about five things. One is posture, and one is the way our teeth are. The way our teeth are arranged in our mouth, and one of them is body size, and one of them is habitat, and one of them is behavior. And I don't know where you are about evolution, and I'm not going to say anything more about it.
All right, we teach in the Southeast.
About 26 million years ago is the first record of apes. First fossil record of apes. About 5 million years ago is the first fossil record of hominids, which are sort of this transitional, or something that looks partly like an ape and has more characteristics of people. About 2.5 million years ago is the first evidence that any creature has used any tools, and this is in a place called Olduvai Gorge, which is in Kenya, and happens to be in the Rift Valley that at some point in the future is going to split apart the very eastern part of Africa from the rest of it. About 200,000 years ago is the indication of Neanderthal man, and about 200,000 years ago is Neanderthal. About 35,000 or less than that is Homo sapiens. And the last way that it's hypothesized that the Earth, or the climate in this case, has some impact on how we got here is that during the last 100,000 years, there have been a number of ice ages. And the theory is that those ice ages have caused environments to change reasonably rapidly, and it is the smart things that do better in those conditions than the big things or the strong things. And therefore, it's the smarter strains of stuff that turned out to be us that did better rather than the bigger or the stronger strains. So, I'm comfortable with my thesis for this week's session, which is that the solid Earth has had a huge impact on life on the planet. It's taken us a long time to get there, but I hope there's some geology that we talked about along the way that you will be able to take away from here with you to wherever else it is that you go next to learn about geology. And since I can't seem to get a lecture done in under an hour, I won't show this piece of video. This is from a TV program called Volcanoes of the Deep. It's on PBS. It's a NOVA thing. It's on PBS. It's another really well-spent hour of your time. I'm not going to show it, David, so don't worry about it. And so to close, we can talk about geology anytime you want. If you see me around the village, I'm going to be here next week. I'm going to talk some more geology next week. It's going to be more pandemonium than this was. I just want to say that I understand that the most important thing that you can share with anybody is your time and your attention. And I really appreciate you spending whatever hours you did this week with me. It's just been a blast. So.